This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT.org to pledge your support. You are listening to KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
And, baby, I got your ringtone.
You do?
Yeah.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
Yes, and this is Queer Voices. We have a couple of guests this evening. Brad Luna, Director of Media Relations with a Human Rights Campaign. He's going to be discussing the upcoming presidential candidates are participating in that historical forum on gay issues on August 9th on Logo. Also, Michael Englehart will be here, an attorney, a local attorney, and we're going to be discussing GLBT legal issues.
And then, J.D., I think we've also got something out of the archives.
We've got something from the Pacifica Archives, which I found lately to be a very rich source of information. They've got some interviews that they captured with some pretty historic people over the years, like Quentin Crisp, and there was a special on the March on Washington. We'll pick one of those for a little later in the show.
Okay, and I guess probably the first thing that we're going to do as soon as I can get the computer
set up. Are we going to have a little news wrap?
Yeah, we're going to do a little bit of news wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Don Lupo.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 14th, 2007. LGBT pride marches continue to be met with resistance in some cities around the world, but strong support in most others. Violence marred a pride parade in the Croatian capital of Zagreb on July 7th. Marko Jurcic, one of the organizers, told Agence France-Presse that police could not protect more than 20 marchers who were targeted by homophobic assaults. About 10 people were hurt and 2 needed medical attention. He said that Italian Senator Giampaolo Silvestri was in one of the groups that was attacked, but was not hurt. Croatia's interior minister and several members of parliament and human rights officials were also at the march. The country's parliament passed legislation giving limited recognition to same-gender couples in 2003, but expanded rights for those couples was on the marchers' political agenda. About 300 people, escorted by close to 500 police officers, braved the jeers and assaults to take part in the 7th annual Pride March through the center of the city. Police reported 8 arrests, including one man who was charged this week with preparing Molotov cocktails he and others planned to throw into the crowd. 2 of his friends, armed with eggs and tomatoes, were arrested on the spot, while the Molotov cocktail-making man was tracked down later. He'll be the first person to face hate crime charges since they were added to Croatia's penal code last year.
Hungary's Secretary of Justice and Law Enforcement said this week that police are searching for more suspects in several homophobic assaults on pride marchers in Budapest on July 7th. 8 attackers were arrested on the scene. Hundreds of skinheads and right-wingers gathered along the route of the city's 12th pride parade to pelt marchers with eggs, smoke bombs, beer bottles, and plastic bags filled with sand. About 2,000 people marched in the Hungarian capital for several miles from Heroes Square to the foot of one of the bridges over the Danube River. Nearly a dozen people, including a German citizen, were reportedly beaten by anti-queer thugs during the march.
But about 200,000 people marched and 300,000 spectators cheered them on at the annual Pride Parade in Mexico City on June 30th, no doubt celebrating the recent advent of civil partnerships for same-gender couples in the country's capital. One observer told gay journalist Rex Wagner that he was particularly delighted to see transgendered mariachi bands, a group of 800 indigenous men from Veracruz dancing naked on the Angel of Independence Monument, and drag queens all dressed as Frida Kahlo with a bad hangover. A raucous concert followed the parade.
LGBT people gathered in Duarte Park in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic on June 28th for their second annual Pride rally. Dozens of lesbians showed up first with rainbow flags, posters, and pamphlets, and then some gay men arrived several hours later, according to a report in El Diario. The newspaper also ran a photo of women wearing t-shirts that said, "I am lesbian because I like it, and that's what I want."
Los Tiempos newspaper reported Cochabamba, Bolivia's first Pride celebration the same day in the form of a fair in the city's main square. A first-ever Pride march followed on June 30th. There was an overflow of glamour, joy, luxury, color, and respect, according to the report, as thousands danced their way from the Plaza of the Flags to Columbus Plaza.
The second annual Festival of Art and Diversity brought 300 people to the Kennedy Mall District in Guayaquil, Ecuador on June 28th under the theme, "The Problem is Not Homosexuality, but Rather Homophobia," capped by a six-hour concert.
The third Pride Parade in Panama City was held June 30th along Argentina Way, ending at Andres Bello Park. Some 260 participants carried signs demanding equal rights and urging tolerance and safe sex.
Hundreds of people marched in San Salvador, El Salvador, July 1st to promote sex education and discourage discrimination. Under the theme Diversity in Action, members of various LGBT women's and HIV organizations joined the walk from the Divine Savior of the World Monument to Civic Plaza. A spokesperson for the organizer said that there's virtually no government support for anti-homophobia or AIDS prevention campaigns in El Salvador.
About 5,000 people gathered in the Plaza de Armas in Santiago, Chile on July 1st for 7 hours of dancing, music, and drag shows. They also demanded passage of anti-discrimination and civil union laws and celebrated the 16th birthday of the nation's leading lesbi-gay rights group, the Movement for Homosexual Integration and Liberation.
In Bogota, Colombia, some 10,000 people marched with pride from National Park to Bolivar Plaza in chilly, rainy weather July 1st. A group of communist youth skinheads supported the parade, chanting, "There is no political freedom without sexual freedom." Political slogans and banners at the march protested the recent demise of Colombia's civil union bill, which, after passing both houses of Congress, was killed in a conference committee by senators who were reportedly pressured by the country's Roman Catholic Church to change their votes. President Álvaro Uribe, a conservative Catholic himself, had promised to sign the bill into law.
But marriage equality in South Africa hasn't guaranteed the safety of gays and lesbians there, and national advocacy groups are calling on the government to do more, in particular to end escalating attacks on lesbians in the black townships. At least 4 women have reportedly been murdered during the past few months because of their sexual orientation. And this week, 30-year-old Cizakele Sagasa, an outreach coordinator at the Positive Women's Network and a lesbi-gay rights activist, and her 23-year-old friend Salome Masua were found tortured, murdered, and dumped in a field in Soweto. Police would only say that Masua had been shot to death, but that Sagasa was found with her hands tied with her underpants, her ankles tied with her shoelaces, and 3 bullet holes in her head and 3 in her collarbone. The Treatment Action Campaign said in a statement that this appears to have been a hate crime committed by people who are intolerant of women and lesbians, and lamented that poverty, unemployment, and cultural attitudes that promote machismo will take generations to resolve.
Australia's federal government has rejected openly gay High Court Justice Michael Kirby's call for equal pension rights for same-gender couples. Parliament is about to consider legislation altering some technical aspects of judges' pensions. Kirby had appealed to Attorney General Philip Ruddock to support a move that would allow his partner of 38 years, Johan van Vloten, to receive a spousal pension, as the spouses of heterosexually married judges do, if he outlives the 68-year-old jurist who retires in 2 years. But a spokeswoman for Ruddock said this week that the government would not support changes to the judges' pensions amendment bill to extend coverage to their same-gender partners because it didn't want to address only one aspect of such proposed entitlements. The conservative federal government of Prime Minister John Howard, however, has long opposed any moves to grant what it has consistently called marriage-like rights to same-gender couples.
In yet another example of the inadequacies of civil union laws in the United States, global shipping giant United Parcel Service said this week that it can't provide health and insurance benefits to the civilly united partners of its union workers in New Jersey because they're available only to legally married couples. The company issued a press release noting that it does provide spousal benefits to married same-gender couples in Massachusetts and that civilly united non-union employees in New Jersey are covered. But, it said, absent a law that specifically categorizes same-sex partners as married spouses, UPS cannot unilaterally change a union contract to offer same-sex benefits, and that civil unions would need to be specifically included when a new contract is negotiated. The New Jersey Supreme Court ruled in October that same-gender couples should be given all the rights of marriage, but let the state legislature decide whether to call those legal relationships marriages or civil unions. The legislature chose civil unions, but since the law took effect February 19th, nearly 1 in 8 of about 1,000 civilly united couples have reported being refused spousal health care benefits by their employers because they aren't legally married. Last month, a review commission created as part of the civil unions legislation was told that the law is not working. Its report to the legislature is generally expected to call for full marriage equality in New Jersey.
And finally, a disgruntled man named Michael McDermott went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C., which hears copyright and trademark cases, claiming that granting San Francisco's Dykes on Bikes a trademark for the exclusive use of that phrase was disparaging to men, scandalous, and immoral, and that the very word dyke is synonymous with a deep, obsessive hatred of men and the male gender. But the federal court ruled 3-0 this week that McDermott had no legal right to sue and that men were not harmed by a group's decision to call itself Dykes. The motorcycle riding Dykes on Bikes has been a fixture in the city by the bay for more than 30 years. The nonprofit group regularly leads San Francisco's Pride Parade, as do similar groups in other cities, and helps LGBT organizations with fundraising. In 2004 and again in 2005, the U.S. Trademark Office rejected the application of Dykes on Bikes because it believed the phrase was disparaging to lesbians. The group then appealed to the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. With the help of the National Center for Lesbian Rights and more than 24 expert declarations from scholars, linguists, psychologists, and activists demonstrating how the word dyke has evolved to become a positive and empowering term, the appeal board ruled in their favor in December 2005, prompting McDermott's lawsuit. This week's court ruling ends the nearly 3-year battle and marks the first time the term dyke has been trademarked.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 14th, 2007, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Don Lupo.
Come and lay down by my side till the early morning light. It's sad to be alone. Help me make it through.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Take the ribbon from your hair. Take it loose and let it fall. Lay it soft upon my skin. Like the shadows on the wall. Come and lay down. Till the early morning light. All I'm taking is your time.
This is J.D. Doyle, and those two groups are very different. I like them both, though. That last track was called Your Touch. It's from the album called Soundtrack for an Aneurysm, and it's by the group calling themselves High School, but High School, H-E-I-S-K-E-L-L, is the name Jeff High School. He used to have his own group called the Judy Betts, which had some success in the early 90s, but this time he's on his own. Before that, we opened with Blue House. Blue House is an Australian duo, and they've been around for quite a number of years, and that, of course, was the Kris Kristofferson song, Help Me Make It Through the Night. It's from their brand new CD called One More Kiss.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee again. And here in our studio, we have Mike Englehart, an attorney at law here in Houston, Texas. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Since I didn't get a bio, you get to tell us.
All right. Well, my name is Mike Englehart, and first let me say it's my pleasure to be here. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you and your audience about me and about what's going on in my life, which is pretty exciting. I'm actually a Democratic candidate, for the 151st Civil District Court, and that election will be next year, 2008.
We have a city election now.
Right. There's city elections coming up right now that are in for the city council. And actually, I've been part of the GLPT group that's been screening these candidates that have come through for various positions, city council, city controller, I think HCC trustee type positions. Mm-hmm. So that's been
HISD? HISD,
okay,
yes,
HISD.
Also.
So learning a lot about that, and I think it's to see things from a GLBT perspective. So that's really been a treat for me as well.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, but I got down here to Texas, as they say in the cliche, as soon as I could. Maybe not as soon as I could, but I have been here since 1992 when I came down to go to the University of Houston Law Center after I graduated college. And I met my wife here, and we got married, and we have two boys. They're 8 and 5, Joey and Zachary, and my wife's name is Eva. Mm-hmm. We live in Bel Air, and I've been a litigator since I was licensed to practice law in 1995. I do mostly personal injury and business litigation, and I represent plaintiffs almost exclusively.
And as far as GLBT issues, have you had a lot of GLBT clients at all, or a few? Tell us about that.
I'd say about a dozen over the years that I've represented. What I do is in personal injury litigation and business litigation. I don't do family law or criminal law, but I've represented a number of people who have been openly gay or lesbian in issues like car accidents and in issues like simple assault cases, not in a criminal sense, but if, for example, I represented a gentleman who was assaulted by his landlord simply because he was openly gay, and the issues involved in litigating those things are, you know, there are differences in litigating those kinds of cases in front of a jury than you might in a regular case not involving a homosexual person.
How so? Tell us some of the particulars.
Well, there were, in every jury trial, you have an issue, you have a, in the beginning, you have to select a jury. People talk about jury selection, but what you're really doing is jury exclusion. You're talking to this group of maybe 25 to 35 people who may potentially serve on your 12-member jury. And you have to find out what their biases and prejudices might be. And you need to find out, you need to do it in a politically sound or a diplomatic way and find out from them if they are, that they in their everyday lives are, tend to be prejudiced against homosexuals or, you know, or biased in some way. Or they find it distasteful, they find that they could not rule or give a fair trial to a person.
Can you ask
GLBT.
Those questions directly, or how do you kind of edge into it?
I'm very direct. I my sense is, and I've gone through seminars and I've tried, you know, many cases, and my sense of it is, if a jury thinks that you're being squirrely about it, you're not being upfront about it, and you're not confronting the issues head on, then they will be equally evasive. I found it's always best to come right out and say, I've tried to cut, you know, I think three cases involving homosexual plaintiffs, or gay or lesbian, and I came right out because those issues were germane to the case, because either the person's demeanor was such that there was, that the jury, if the jury wasn't asked about it and wasn't told about it, might speculate about it, which is, I think, equally as harmful in being able to predict the outcome of the case. So I go right at it and I say, listen, one of the issues in this case that I need to find out about in order to find out if you're the best person to serve on this jury is, what are your thoughts about homosexuality, about the, you know, the gay or lesbian lifestyle, people who are gays or lesbians or bisexual or transgendered? I have not had cases involving a transgendered man or woman. But I come right out and ask about it, and I found, by and large, despite their reputation, that Harris County jurors will give you a straight answer. And if they say that they cannot give a fair trial, or they feel like they would be biased or prejudiced in some way, and that your client would be starting at a disadvantage because of that, their status or their sexual orientation or preference, that those people can be struck for cause in those cases if the judge feels like those issues are central enough to the case or important enough to the case.
Now, you mentioned there the judge. How many times have you run into judges who, you know, don't handle or deal with that in an unbiased way their own self? Since you're asking them to, for cause, set aside somebody because they particularly, don't care for GLBT people, then... What do you do then? Or have you run into that situation?
You know, I have to say that for the most part, the couple of judges that I've been in front of where this was squarely an issue have demonstrated themselves to be reasonably enlightened people, and have treated that issue on the merits, as opposed to suggesting or implying some sort of political bias or some personal bias that they have. So it hasn't really become an issue. If I was able to strike jurors because they said out loud in open court that they could not be fair in such a case where they felt like they would be biased or prejudiced, and those jurors were excused for cause.
Now, as far as your cases that you've had, how do you see yourself, if the roles were reversed and you were the judge and GLBT people were, you know, coming before you, how familiar are you with the GLBT issues in that respect?
Well, it's been very educational to be part of the GLBT PC here in Houston, and I've learned a lot, and I've done some research on my own, because I wanted to be a useful member of the organization. Here's what I think. Getting away from just the specific legal issues, let me just say this to begin with. It is in my DNA that all men and women are created equal. That's where I start from. I do not believe in discriminating against people for any reason, especially something that is out of their control. I believe that gays and lesbians are born that way. I believe that transgendered people, those that I've met, have clearly shown to be, to have gender identity disorder, and have been, the language of the law is in some old, actually relatively old case law, is that they are cruelly trapped in the wrong gendered body, and that they have every right to have that corrected surgically, or in their, just the way they hold themselves out to the world. And so there's absolutely no difference in the way that I would treat gays, lesbians, bisexual, transgendered people in my courtroom than any other person, black, white, Chinese, anything that came before me. That's the starting point. Mm-hmm. Completely equal in my mind. And no reason to discriminate one way or the other.
Now, you said you'd done some research. What sort of that old piece of case law seemed very interesting. How old was that?
I got it. Well, I think it's probably every bit of 30 years old. And I'll see if I can dig it up for you.
Who the heck was the enlightened back there?
It was a discussion of that specific issue. I think the Ulane case and the Price Waterhouse case go back quite a while. The Price Waterhouse case involved a transgendered person. It was a United States Supreme Court case, and it involved Title VII.
Correct.
And Title VII, I'm sure your listeners know, listening to you, has to do with discrimination in employment. It's a federal statute. Although, interestingly enough, there is what they call concurrent jurisdiction in both federal and state courts. So I've brought Title VII discrimination claims in state courts, and I've brought them in federal courts. And so as a judge in the 151st Civil District Court, Title VII cases are certainly ones that could come before me. And just as a caution, part of the rules in running for the position of judge is you really can't give your opinion as to how you would rule on a specific issue. But let me talk historically here a little bit about the law. The Price Waterhouse case dealt with transgendered issues and employment discrimination. It was an employee that was, if I remember correctly, terminated because. And then the issue was, why were they terminated? Were they terminated because of their transgendered status, or were they terminated because the view was that they did not fit a particular gender stereotype? That is. A woman is supposed to be, the stereotype is, a woman is supposed to be feminine, and a man is supposed to be macho and aggressive. That's putting it very broadly, but that's the essence of the distinction. So, in that case, the court held that Title VII bars discrimination on the basis of sex. And historically, that's meant discriminating against a man because they're a man, or discriminating against a woman because she's a woman. But the Price Waterhouse case went further and said, if you discriminate against a woman, for example, who is transgendered and acts more masculinely than you would expect, you would think that a woman would, and you discriminate against them because they have too firm a handshake, they're too aggressive, they don't wear skirts, things like that, that is, in fact, discrimination on the basis of sex, because of it is someone who does not live up to a specific gender stereotype. And that kind of claim, that kind of discrimination claim, is actionable under Title VII. And so that's one of the issues that I've researched lately, because there's a fair amount of new law and better case law for plaintiffs, transgendered people who have been discriminated against, than there has been in the past. In the Fifth Circuit here in Texas, there's really not much law at all on that subject, although there is a new case, the Lopez case against River Oaks Imaging, that's been filed by Lambda Legal Defense in December of last year in the Southern District of Texas, that seeks to be the first to, shall we say, enlighten the Fifth Circuit courts with the same kind of rulings that have come out of the Sixth Circuit, which is, I think, Michigan and Ohio and Indiana, and some other and more progressive courts like the Ninth Circuit, which is California and the West.
Now, talking about transgender, but in relation to gay and lesbians, here in this state, it seems to have been put upon by the state legislature. However, there are supportive case law to protect the rights, and that I understand. I'm not an attorney, but I only read what I read in the paper or other news sources. How do you see that in case law here within this state and within this circuit?
Well, you're right in that there's been a number of actual, I would say, changes in the law that disfavor the GLBT community in Texas. There was, although there's been some that have gone the other way. For example, the Lawrence decision, which I'm sure all your listeners are very familiar with, was a United States Supreme Court case that invalidated the anti-sodomy statute or statutes in Texas. One of the, I think it might have been Justice O'Connor actually considered it, called it a quaint or a relic of an earlier, of a bygone era or an earlier era. There have been, but then at the same time, there have been decisions regarding civil unions and homosexual marriage or gay marriage or civil unions in Texas where there was a constitutional amendment, I believe, just a few years ago that ruled against, where the voters of Texas spoke out. And I remember being involved in that campaign, and there was some optimism that that would that it would not turn out that way. People felt that maybe they could campaign and they could convince and enlighten people, as had but it may have been just a little bit too early, because in other states in the country there's been some great progress made, which you and your listeners know about, in Massachusetts and New Jersey, California, but in Texas, there is no protection for, is written into the state law, not just the state constitution, but that there's nothing, there can be nothing like a gay marriage, there can be nothing like even civil unions. The rights that heterosexual couples enjoy in terms of visiting each other in the hospital when the other is sick, inheritance type issues. There's a huge long list of rights that heterosexual couples enjoy that homosexual couples simply cannot enjoy in Texas. And in fact, under the Defense of Marriage Act and I think Texas state law itself, they will not recognize a gay marriage from another state in Texas. Period. The end.
Now, doesn't that fly in the face of the 10th Amendment?
Well, the 10th Amendment says that all the powers that are not given to the federal government are reserved to the states. And there's been an interesting discussion about states' rights throughout our history, unless I'm misremembering that, that states' rights have been used for lots of different issues. The states' rights were invoked during the civil rights movement, when southern states wanted to hold on to their Jim Crow laws and fight the federal government's forced integration and things like that. So the states' rights argument can go both ways.
But how is it, I'm a novice at this, and maybe you can enlighten us, and how is it that in the past many state laws passed in some states were recognized in other states? Marriages are recognized state to state. So why is it they're opting to out where is it that in our government in the United States that states were doing these things and now suddenly, no, I don't like this law, so I'm not going to respect it?
Well, there's two things. There is one provision of the United States Constitution, and I have to tell you, listeners, I am not an expert on all of these issues, but I'll tell you what my understanding is and what and it's this. There's the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution that basically says that each state has to give legal effect to the legal enactments, and that would include, for example, marriages that are governed by state law to another state. Now, I think it was Bill Clinton that signed something called the Defense of Marriage Act, and that said that states do not have to recognize things having to do with like marriages in other states, or certainly not gay marriages from other states. And there is some question as to whether that is in fact constitutional or whether the Defense of Marriage Act actually violates the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution, which is one of the reasons, or which probably the main reason, why the Bush administration within the last couple of years had been pushing this federal marriage amendment, where they were seeking to actually amend the Constitution of the United States so that it would allow one state to refuse to recognize the gay marriage decision of another state.
But wouldn't that fly in the face of a lot of other issues, too? I mean, you could, obviously, we don't have a Supreme Court that probably would uphold such a thing now, but there are a multitude of issues that states, just in general, respect laws, circumstances in every other state. But here we are now, selectively choosing from state to state, Texas being one of those, and in some cases passing constitutional amendments not recognizing those same situations. It seems to fly in the face of you know, the Constitution itself.
I agree, and let me tell you what I think needs to happen. It is selective. It is based on what I consider to be bigotry and hatred, prejudice. It is ignorance. It is people who are so insecure with themselves or see political opportunity to ride to office on the backs of what has historically been a very disadvantaged community. And I'm talking about the GLBT community. This community, unlike just about any other in the last 20 or 30 years, has been rhetorically beaten mercilessly. It is mistreated. It is thrown around like a rag doll just to get votes, and by people who are just so full of hate and insecurity in their own lives and so dissatisfaction with their own station in life that they have to find somebody else to hate. And unfortunately, up until now, the law has allowed them to get away with that with impunity. And I think we're getting to the point, slowly, and from the north and west, hopefully moving towards the south and east of the country, we're getting to a point where people are starting to realize that, for example, in Massachusetts, where there's been gay marriage for a couple of years now, if I'm following that correctly, the sky is not falling.
The society didn't fall apart.
No. You know, dogs and cats are not living together. It's not total anarchy or mass hysteria. People's marriages, I mean, it's cliche by now, but heterosexual marriage fails at what? At a rate of 50%.
50% even.
Yeah. And to say that dedicated couples, two men or two women who love each other, who want to be together, who want to raise a family, who want to have dogs and cats, who want to take care of each other when they're old, who
and
want to
have children,
and have right, and adopt children, or have children of their own, biological children, should be denied that, I think, requires a very just a mean-spiritedness and ignorance.
That's exactly where I was going to help you.
Mean-spirited. Mean-spirited, yes.
Now, as a judicial candidate, does that mean I'm going to rule, you know, I'm going to go against the law? Well, what I would hope to do as a judge is be open-minded about the idea of if a law needs to change because it is unconstitutional. And I say unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution, under the Equal Protection Clause. If it needs to change, then I'm not going to be the kind of judge that sits there and says, my hands are tied. Because if the law, there's more than one kind of law. There's statutes that are written, and then there's the Constitution. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The Constitution gives judges the power, if necessary, to say, and I do this in other contexts. I've argued about the constitutionality of other statutes in cases I've been involved in. I'm not shy about that. If the arguments, the cogent arguments, are presented to me and brought to me in briefs that are well thought out and well reasoned and persuasive, then I am not going to be the kind of judge that says, well, you know, we're not going to revisit this. The legislature has already spoken. Because the judiciary is another branch of government that is co-equal with the legislature. As a district judge, I have the jurisdiction, I would have the jurisdiction, and the power, the ability to keep an open mind, analyze these things, and decide whether a statute passed by the legislature actually is up to constitutional muster.
Well, another thing, too, that doesn't get much conversation is the jury nullification. That's a jury of 12 people or 6 people could actually set aside a law that the legislature has passed.
Yes and no. A lot of times this will come in the context of a legal argument as opposed to a factual argument. Let's talk about Title VII cases. Let's go back to that for a minute. There are both legal issues and factual issues involved in the type of discrimination that was alleged in Price Waterhouse. When the case went up to the United States Supreme Court, it was a legal question for the judge or the Supreme Court to decide, does this kind of claim exist? Is there a legal animal? Is there a legal hole that this peg can go into? Is there what they call a cause of action, a recognized legal claim, or is there a good argument to be made for creating a new legal claim? And I think the Price Waterhouse case did create a new legal animal, a new legal tool for lawyers to use in, for example, transgender discrimination cases. And so then, once that happens, once the Supreme Court says, yes, there is such a claim that one is allowed to bring if they have certain facts that they can allege, then it goes back to the jury, back to the trial court, the various lowest level court, for there to be a trial and a jury to decide those factual questions, which were, was this person in fact discriminated against in this way, yes or no? Jury answered that question. And so then the jury sits as the fact finder. So I think you're exactly right in the sense that we have to educate people before they ever get to the courthouse.
Absolutely.
About these kinds of issues so that they can be better jurors in the long run and help promote the progression of the law.
Mike, I really appreciate you being here tonight. I've enjoyed it. Got an opportunity to get some information, found out something new.
I think he needs to come back closer to the election.
I think that'll be the case. We're a little, but I didn't want to get him too close, you know, out of favoritism, but I did want to hear some of the information you've got. Thank you so much for being part of Queer Voices.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Trolling in the park today. Boy so faint, his mother's misty eyes meet mine. This instant where we both divide.
Down.
This is J.D., and that's another track by Heiskell, H-E-I-S-K-E-L-L, from the album Soundtrack for an Aneurysm. I like that one because it has transgender lyrics. It's called The Death of Knoxville Cool.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee again. I don't know if any of you, if you haven't, I'm going to give you a little information. It says, and this is the headline on here, leading presidential candidates to participate in historic forum on gay issues. And the rest of the information, the Human Rights Campaign Foundation and MTV Networks logo channel to co-present live televised event August 9th with co-panelists Melissa Etheridge and Joe Solomes. And I had to get someone on to talk to us about this because since it is historic. And I have with us a representative from the Human Rights Campaign, Brad Luna. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on Queer Voices.
Oh, you're very welcome. I, quite honestly, when I saw this come across my email blurb, one of the alerts coming from HRC, I said, oh my God, that is wonderful. Now, according to the information I had when I printed this out, there was only Hillary and Barack Obama had signed up for it. Can you give us any new information?
Absolutely. We are fortunate enough to have Senator Clinton, Senator Barack Obama, former Senator John Edwards, Senator Chris Dodd, Governor Bill Richardson, and former Senator Mike Gravel have all, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich have all RSVP'd that they would be attending the forum. The only one who's not able to come out of all the Democratic presidential candidates is Senator Joe Biden because he has had a previous scheduling engagement. But we're very excited to have all but one Democratic candidate joining us on the stage.
Now, before we get into the format and all for this presentation, a little history. How did this come about?
Well, back in 2003, HRC did a presidential forum, but at that time, there was no logo. There was no cable channel that was dedicated for the gay audience. So it was just a presentation that was given to HRC members in the audience, and then the press who attended were able to carry it out. But this is the first time ever that we've exclusively had a live televised forum that will be televised to the gay community. And those people who don't have logo on their cable network provider can go to logoonline.com and watch it, a live video stream of it. So we're really excited about it to have this partnership with Logo to provide this service to the community.
How did the two connect up?
Well, you know, Logo being a major provider of entertainment content and news content to the GLBT community and the Human Rights Campaign have a working relationship that goes back to the start of Logo. So, you know, we have a relationship with them that is a very positive relationship. And initially, they both of us sort of went to each other at a meeting and started talking about it, and it grew from there.
So when did y'all set the date for this? And then what kind of early response did you get when you first put out the notice and the invitations?
Well, we initially were looking at a date, that fit the presidential candidates. There's obviously a lot of forums are going to, from labor unions to environmental groups to Democratic clubs. So we wanted to make sure that we found a time that, you know, we would be able to sort of exclusively have that night for our issues. And that's how we decided on August 9th. And it was the response has been really outstanding. I mean, from the very beginning, these Democratic presidential candidates have done a lot to, seek out our community and talk to us about the issues that they care about and that we care about. And this is just another logical step for the Human Rights Campaign to take to try to provide a forum for the GLBT community to become educated on where the candidates stand on the issues that are important to our lives.
I guess it's, to me, a little surprising that so, now that you've given me the full list, surprising that so many candidates want to come to a forum to discuss GLBT issues. Obviously, our issues are dear, near and dear to our hearts, but a lot of time all we've gotten is a little should I say, lip service from many of the major candidates, many of whom our community has supported wholeheartedly. And I was just pleasantly surprised and delighted that so many had accepted the invitation to come on.
It's not 2004 anymore, is it?
No, it's not.
It's definitely a different world from the 2004 presidential election, and that's a welcome sign to us. You know, I think the first signs we got of the support that we were going to be getting from these presidential candidates came in the form of our questionnaire that we sent out. And for the first time ever, every Democratic candidate completed the questionnaire, and every Democratic candidate stated that they were for federally recognizing same-sex relationships when it comes to benefits and taxation issues, and that would be a repeal of a section of DOMA. So from that point sort of on, we've had a lot of positive response. You know, there was a CNN debate in New Hampshire where Wolf Blitzer asked the candidates if they were for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell to raise your hand, and that what will become a famous photo was, you know, every Democratic presidential candidate sticking their hand in the air in favor of repeal of that policy. So, you know, it's been a very welcome surprise to us, and a very, you know, outstanding thing for, I think, the country and for our community, that these candidates have been so willing to go out there and talk to our community and not go behind a closed door and sort of whisper where they stand on issues and then expect us to understand when they go back out in public and don't want to talk about it. But they've been really willing this election cycle to go out and very publicly state to, you know, gay audiences and mixed audiences where they stand on issues of equality.
Yeah, because back in 2004, we were a punching bag for the religious right. And they used us as, you know, the target to drum up support for their own troops. And we took a severe beating in that in many, many ways. Now, what has been the response that you've received from different venues?
It's been a very positive response. I think people in the community are extremely excited about this opportunity. You know, it's going to be in LA at a TV studio there, where it'll be broadcast, and we'll have a chance to speak to, it was originally 60 minutes, and now it's grown to 90 minutes, and there's actually talk of making it 2 hours long. So it'll definitely give us a chance to explore in depth where candidates stand on the issues, because, you know, a lot of times, especially when it comes to our issues in the GLBD community, we are one question in, you know, a 2 hour presidential debate, and it sort of becomes a back and forth on, you know, just a quick one-liner, a soundbite on where the candidates stand. But this will really give us an opportunity to talk to them about their plans, how they are planning on going about changing these policies, and, you know, what are they going to implement when they get into office.
So let's go back to the, since we were, you're having it there, what kind of format is it going to be set up in? I know that Joe Solomes and Melissa Etheridge are going to be on the panel. Give us a little rundown on what to expect.
Well, we will, in the next few days, probably be announcing further announcements about the forum. There will be a journalist moderating the forum, and potentially another journalist joining the panel discussion. But, so, you know, there will be a focus directly on the GLBT community and on our issues. So, you know, we're not interested. There's a lot of different venues where candidates can talk about, you know, sort of generic how they're going to, you know, reduce the budget or healthcare issues that aren't related to the GLBT community. Obviously, those that are, we'll want to explore those. But so sort of what you should expect is each candidate will be asked questions and follow-up questions, specifically drilling down on where they stand on issues, you know, ranging from relationship recognition to workplace fairness to HIV/AIDS funding, hate crimes, employment non-discrimination, a lot of different issues. And each of the candidates will, you know, receive a series of questions from the panelists, and also the moderator will have the ability to jump in and talk about, you know, an issue a little bit further and drive them in a certain direction. If there will be a mechanism as well that we're setting up with Logo to receive questions online from members of the community, so we can sort of gauge what the interest is and make sure that those questions are being asked.
I know that it's, and I do it myself, I'm just as guilty as the next, that we just sort of roll off GLBT or LGBT, whichever, in the whole business. And since I'm a T in the GLBT, are there going to be any, can I expect to hear any specific questions concerning the transgender? Because it seems to me in my own experience that politicians don't have a whole lot of information about the transgender community.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're going to strive to do, and I'd encourage your listeners that, you know, it'll be up probably in a week or two, to go to the HRC.org website and look for ways to submit questions, because one of the things that we definitely want to do is, you know, talk about the diversity of our community, to explore all the different issues, regardless if you're the G, the L, the B, or the T, to make sure that those top issues that are of a real concern to your life, sort of your kitchen table issues that are important to you on a daily basis, are being talked about and being explored. So, you know, I think one of the best ways to make sure that that happens is for people to go online, to log on, to submit their questions, and to make sure that those issues are being highlighted. But we have a real sensitivity to that and want to make sure that the diversity of our community is explored.
And well, I know that I'm as a member of HRC myself, that it's important, and part of the diversity and the maybe the changing face, if you will, of the HRC is about diversity and bringing all aspects of our total community together, and feeling each part, feeling that they are part of the whole and part of making things happen. Any other question, any other information you'd like to throw my way that I may need to know about? And also, don't forget to give me that email address again. I didn't have time to write it down.
Absolutely. If people just go back and check on our main website, www.hrc.org, there will be continuing updates throughout this process to let your listeners know what the new twists and turns are that we're going to be unveiling in the next, you know, week to 2 weeks. And also, it'll give a chance for the listeners to ask questions to be sent in that will be part of the broadcast. But it's going to be at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on August 9th. Right now, it's a 90-minute forum, but there are talks for it to be a two-hour forum. So it will definitely be a good chance for people to hear in-depth conversations about where the candidates stand on the issues. And if you don't have Logo then on your cable network provider, then you can go to logoonline.com and listen to it with the live video stream on the website.
Well, there is a live video stream.
Yes, there will be. So those people who don't have Logo on their cable providers will be able to listen to it live online.
Will it be archived for download or reviewing later?
Absolutely. We will most likely have a component of that on the HRC website as well. I mean, this is something that, you know, we don't want it just to be a day in time, but to make sure that, you know, when people go to the polls and the primaries, you know, 6 months from now, 8 months from now, that they have a chance to reference back to where these candidates stand on the issues and what they had to say.
Okay. One additional question, and not to poke a stick in anybody's eye, did you send any invitations to Republican candidates?
We did. We have sent them our questionnaire, the first step in this process, and didn't get any of those returned. And we invited the Republican candidates as well, and only heard back from Governor Mitt Romney, who said no, and the rest of them have not responded. So it's unfortunate. We wish that they would obviously stand up and talk to our community, but at this point it doesn't seem like there's a real interest on the other side.
Okay, well, thank you. Brad, I really appreciate you coming on tonight and talking with us about the upcoming candidate forum, which is on August 6th, and here in Houston, that'd be at 8 p.m. on Logo. And how about if you come back afterwards, we'll have you back on, and you can tell us from the inside how it all went.
Absolutely. I would love to. Thank you for having me on tonight. Anytime we can provide any information, be sure and let us know.
I've got your cell number. You're in trouble now.
I'm tagged.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great night.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This
human rights activist Victor Juliet Mukasa is suing her government for invasion of privacy. 2 years ago, her suburban Kampala home was raided by officials searching for incriminating evidence of her lesbianism. Another woman staying there at the time was arbitrarily arrested and subjected to humiliating treatment. The Ugandan Constitution proclaims equality for all and discrimination against none. But Mukasa and her Kenyan friend, Yvonne Oyo, say they've suffered persistent police harassment because of their sexual orientation. Joshua Chalimpa of Free Speech Radio News reports from Kampala.
Uganda's penal code imposes the maximum penalty of life imprisonment if one is found guilty of what it terms having carnal knowledge against the order of nature. It is, however, difficult to convict suspects under this law, especially if prohibited acts are between consenting adults. The police have generally arrested people without preferring specific charges against them. Victor Juliet Mukasa's house was targeted in such a sweep in July 2005.
What happened is that my house was forcefully entered into by government agents. They took my documents without my permission. They assaulted my friend, who they found. She was assaulted. She was taken to police in a very indecent manner. She was forced to undress for them to prove that she's a biological female. We were treated in a very degrading and inhuman way. They accused us of being lesbians. They accused us of being feminists. They accused us of dressing like men and behaving like men. All this amounts to violation of our basic human rights, which we are entitled to.
Mukasa and her friend were subsequently released without charge, but laid a complaint almost 2 years after the incident. There has been no government investigation or action. A report developed by Sexual Minorities Uganda, a network of several gay and lesbian groups working to achieve equality and justice for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender, LGBT individuals in Uganda, and the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission last year, accused the Ugandan government of torture and cruel and degrading treatment of members of the LGBT community. But Dr. James Nsawakutula, Uganda's Minister for Ethics and Integrity, defends the police action.
The police you're talking about are actually doing their work, because the law is very, very specific about that particular situation. And so, of course, the gays and lesbians here, when the law catches up with them, it is in their interest to say they are being harassed.
Mukasa's lawsuit claims her treatment is a violation of her right to privacy. The case is a landmark legal step in the fight for the civil rights of the entire LGBT community. But the Minister for Ethics and Integrity insists constitutional protection cannot apply here.
In Uganda, we've chosen to say homosexuality, bisexualism, etc., these very strange situations are abnormal. They are not acceptable. They are against nature. Those are our laws. Now, the problem with Ugandans who claim they are homos, they are dancing to the tune of external interests.
But Mukasa's Kenyan partner, Yvonne Oyo, says homosexuality is not alien to Africa.
In my country, the Kambas, it was allowed. And then in the Maasai's, the warriors were allowed to take boy wives. In the Nandi tradition, women were allowed to get married to each other. In the Kisi tradition, women were allowed to get married to each other, even to live together. So I think this is something that has come from way back. It is not something that people just discovered after the coming of the Europeans.
If the judges rule in favor of Oyo and Mukasa, it will be a first step towards legalizing homosexuality in Uganda. Many Ugandans go into hiding in order to avoid arrest, extortion and other forms of harassment. A victory for the gays in this case will be just one step in what may be a long struggle for justice in a homophobic society. Joshua Chalimpa, Free Speech Radio News, Kampala, Uganda.
South Africa takes the lead, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. South Africa's National Assembly passed a bill that provides for the voluntary union of two persons, which could be registered as either a marriage or civil union. The legislation came just days before December 1st, 2006 deadline imposed by the country's constitutional court. This law makes South Africa the first country on the continent of Africa where same-gender couples can wed. During a two-hour emotionally charged debate, Defense Minister Motsiwa Lakota reminded lawmakers that many homosexuals, along with African National Congress members, went into exile in prison under white racist rule. Lakota said, quote, "This country cannot afford to be a prison of time-worn prejudices which have not a place in modern society. Let us bequeath to future generations a society which is more democratic and tolerant than the one that was handed down to us." Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John Klein.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
A new coffee table book captures the struggle to win the right to marry in Massachusetts and the reasons that victory meant so much to so many. This Way Out's Josie Catoggio chats with Karen Kahn, who authored Courting Equality, a documentary history of America's first legal same-sex marriages, along with her partner, Patricia A. Gazimba, and photographer Marilyn Humphreys.
First of all, as a feminist, I have to ask the obvious question, why marriage? You know, Emma Goldman said, any woman who reads the marriage laws and then signs on anyway deserves what she gets. Traditionally, marriage has always been about property. You know, the father gives the woman to the husband like she's a cow.
You know, I have to say that I was never a big marriage enthusiast, which is in some ways terribly ironic that I ended up writing a book about the struggle for same-sex marriage. But when the marriage decision happened here in Massachusetts, both Pat and I were completely bowled over by the language that the court actually used in the decision, where they really talked about, you know, that this is a fundamental human right, and why shouldn't we have it as gay people? This is like the most important social institution in our society, whether we want it or not. And it's evolved. It's changed over the last, you know, 200 years. It isn't just about property anymore. And in fact, many of the benefits that our society gives to people around health care and taking care of their families, protection, come through marriage. So without it, gay people are really left out. So it is very important. And in fact, I was listening to the attorney who won the Goodrich case actually tonight, and as she said, you can't be for equality and against marriage.
Well, why not civil unions? A lot of people say, well, you know, people get upset about marriage because they see that as a religious institution. So what's wrong with civil unions? I mean, doesn't that give you all the same basic rights? You just don't call it that word that gets right-wingers so upset.
But if they don't want to give us the word, obviously they think we're second-class citizens, and they want to give us something that's a second-class thing, which is, I mean, what do you say? I was civil union today. It doesn't really roll off the tongue, and on top of that, it's a wonderful thing, and I don't want to put it down. It's wonderful that in the last few years, as a movement, we now have almost full recognition of our relationships in 10 states. Now, a few years ago, we had no states, so it's made a big difference, but it isn't marriage, and partly it isn't marriage because it is offered by our state, so each state has different sets of benefits and rights that come with a civil union, and if I have a civil union in, you know, in Vermont or Connecticut, you know, do I know if my civil union will be recognized? If you walked into a hospital in some, let's say you were visiting in Ohio and your partner got ill and you had to go into a hospital and you said, well, we have a civil union, that isn't necessarily going to say to them that you are the next of kin.
Also, I was impressed that in the book you compared it a lot to the old anti-miscegenation laws. Can you talk about that?
That's right. You know, there's a whole series of cases in the United States Supreme Court that have been about marriage. And basically, starting in 1948 with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, marriage has been defined as a fundamental right. Well, actually, not marriage itself, but the right to choose the person whom you want to marry. Up until 1967, it was in many states illegal to marry a person of another race. And it's interesting when you look back at those law cases, and ironically, the name of the case that changed all of that and was the Supreme Court that ended anti-miscegenation laws, it was called the Loving case.
Ah.
After a man in Virginia, where a man and a woman tried to get married there, different races, and they were refused a marriage license. They actually had to move out of state. They were arrested for marrying. So in the Loving case, the court basically said you have the right to choose the person, to marry the person that you choose. That's a fundamental human right. And so what was the Supreme Court in Massachusetts said when they made the ruling in the Goodrich case was this is the same thing. It's just that instead of race, it's a person of the same sex. And the only reason we don't allow people to do that is that we have deep-seated prejudice against people who love members of their own sex. You know, we're fighting for civil marriage, and in fact, 40% of the people in this country who get married only have a civil ceremony. That's, you know, we don't realize that because it's so, wound up with religion and spiritual life that people forget that. Mm-hmm. It is a civil issue.
I'm talking with Karen Kahn, K-A-H-N, who wrote with her partner Patricia A. Gozemba and photographer Marilyn Humphreys the book Courting Equality, a documentary history of America's first legal same-sex marriage.
I don't think any of us should think that the winning marriage equality is the end of the LGBT struggle or any other struggle in this country. It's not the be-end and all. And all of justice. It's just one little piece, and we shouldn't be left out of that piece right now, and we should all be fighting so that we all have health care benefits and that we all have the rights, you know, to be full citizens and fully realized people in whatever kind of relationships we want to have. But this right now, I think, is a very important way for people to understand gay relationships and recognize them.
Yeah, and one of the things that made me really cognizant of this is how much it's an economic issue.
I can't tell you how many just horrendous stories I heard when we were writing this book and we were, you know, trying to look at everything there was out there about marriage, and there are just some just heartrending stories of, you know, people who, these two guys I remember in the Midwest who had a farm together, and one of them dies and the other one, you know, loses the farm to some relative who never even
exactly
spoke to them.
And frequently some homophobic relative comes
control
of the property and the funeral. You can't even go to your own partner's funeral or arrange things the way they would have wanted them done.
And, you know, the AIDS crisis made people realize that if you have no legal relationship to your partner, you can get really, really screwed.
Yeah. When lesbians and gay men started having families, had to have equal protection for their children.
Many states now have second parent adoption, which means a child can legally have two parents of the same sex, but those two parents can have no legal relationship to each other.
Right, and when partners break up, and then the whole thing needs to be adjudicated, and you sometimes can't have a relationship if you weren't the birth parent.
Right,
it's insane.
Exactly.
It's completely insane.
I mean, marriage is partly important because of that thing called divorce, which, of course, we don't want to think about because we like to have fuzzy, warm feelings about marriage, but it's a legal structure, and it means that if you do break up, there's a legal structure in which you can divide your property and work out your visitation rights and all of those other things, and that's a very important part because we're all human and we don't always stay together. A lot of people, I think that the only people getting married are people, you know, white people who have a lot of privilege. But in fact, I talk to a lot of working class women, I'm not as familiar with men, who really want to get married because of what we were talking about, the economic issues. It's very important to people to have the economic security. It's also an issue for people who are old, because many people who don't have access to their partner's pensions, their social security, those issues.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell me?
I would love to tell you that people can find out more about the book. They can go to our website, which is www.courtingequality.com. just as one word, .com, and we have lots of the pictures, which we haven't talked about. It's just a marvelous book in terms of its
color. Oh, the pictures are gorgeous. It's this big, beautiful picture book with wonderful quotations from all kinds of people.
So go there. You can see some of the pictures. We're starting to put up some reviews. There's a blog there. If you want to talk more about the marriage issue, we'd love people to contribute.
Oh, cool.
So come to the website and take a look.
Karen Kahn is co-author with her partner, Patricia A. Gozemba, and with photographer Marilyn Humphreys of Courting Equality, a documentary history of America's first legal same-sex marriages. It's published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josie.
And that was This Way Out correspondent Josie Cotoggio. Tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Don Lupo, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with John Klein, and Josie Cotoggio contributed program material. Thanks also to reporter Joshua Chenlimpa of Free Speech Radio News and to J.D. Doyle. The Chixie Dicks, featuring Hedda Lettuce, sang Marry Me, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. You can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are supported by direct tax-deductible donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and get some unique thank you CD gifts in return. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly program there. To request a CD or cassette copy of this week's program, or to sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email TWORadio@AOL.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on CHMA Sackville, New Brunswick, WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Closet, cause I'm from the Bible Belt, and my daddy is a Bible thumper blues. I've got the living in the closet, cause Papa is a rabbi, and being gay is not good for the Jews. I've got the living in the closet, cause it would kill my mother, that's how powerful I am. I've got the living in the closet, cause I'm in the military, and I can't afford to piss off Uncle Sam. These are all such fine excuses, far be it from me. Let's just say that you are gay and living privately. I've got the living in the closet, cause I'm the famous actor that all the straight women like to cruise. I've got the living in the closet, I'm an actress, and I don't want to foster any rumors in the news. It would ruin my career, and I want to make more money. But you've got millions stashed away, so I don't want to hear it, honey. I've got the living in the closet, cause my coworkers can't tell, so I let them all believe that I am straight. I've got the living in the closet, cause I'm so afraid to try it, all I do is stay at home and masturbate. I've got the living in the closet, cause I'm from the tacky suburbs, and conformity is the American way. I've got the living in the closet blues. for everybody else's sake. These are all such fine excuses, but I don't really care. If you really care about social change, then come out of that closet, I dare you.
Very cute and very short. That was from 2001, Amy Fix and Closet.
This is Queer Voices.
Hey, this is Jennifer Renee again. I want to ask, next week we have Queer Music Heritage,
right,
WJD.
And that's part three of my Transgendered Artist Series. I'll have an interview with two trans men, plus a lot of other interesting music besides. I've been working on those interviews this week, and they are very good. They, you know, not that I did a great job, but they did a great job explaining what's important to their lives. And coming up next, we have a special feature from the Pacific Archives. It's a little documentary they did on the 1979 March on Washington. You'll hear some familiar voices in it, including our own Ray Hill.
Across the country lately, millions of people are marching for their rights. But this chanting you're hearing now is from a different generation. This is From the Vault Remixed, a weekly program presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives. I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the archive. Each week, we pick a subject, sometimes date-specific, sometimes seemingly random, and we go through the Pacifica Radio Archives vault, the largest of its kind in the country, and pull out the best programs possible and remix them into something we hope you'll come to look forward to, set your watches by, or grab the whole family and listen. Listen to the power of radio. This week, we look at the 1979 March on Washington for gay and lesbian rights.
Sunday, October 14th, 1979. For millions of Americans and the national media, it was just another news day. But for hundreds of thousands of lesbians, gay men, and their friends, October 14th, 1979 was the date of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, the first such event in American history. On that day, thousands of people from all over the country converged on the nation's capital to march past the White House and to gather together at the Washington Monument for a rally of mutual support and celebration. In the spirit of significant past marches in the nation's capital, lesbians and gay men came to Washington in astonishing numbers to demonstrate to lawmakers and to the national press that the growing lesbian and gay movement for human rights and human dignity in the 1970s would continue to be a major social and political force in the 1980s.
What we really want to do with this march is build a national consciousness around gay oppression. Freedom is never given to anybody, and unless we continue in our effort without putting our energy and our direction into a further action, a further effort, we will not get our freedom because nobody's going to give it to us.
We shall go.
The march didn't just happen, though. Like all great things, it first germinated as an idea in someone's head. But today there is some controversy over who first had the idea. Ray Hill, who is the lead organizer of the event, says Harvey Milk first came up with the idea in 1976. Harvey Milk later became the first elected gay official in the country, elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1977.
The conference that did call for the march happened in Philadelphia, and it happened in Independence Hall on Quaker turf, and that happened in February of 1979. Among those people that were present but not supporting the march was Troy Perry. And I've known Troy Perry since '68. So Troy and I are old friends, and Troy was just opposed to the march. The name Robin Tyler, in relationship to the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights in 1979, did not appear until Troy had a heart-to-heart talk with God and changed his position on the march and said he would support the march and lead a train from Los Angeles across the country, gathering march participants along the way. And part of that was contingent that we put Robin Tyler in a position of being on the podium with me as co-moderator of the rally at the end of the march. And that's the first time Robin Tyler's name appeared in relationship to that march. And that's just the facts.
But Robin Tyler, a lesbian comedienne, claims the idea first came to her while on stage in Minnesota.
I was doing a benefit in St. Paul when they had the referendum there, and I made a joke. The joke was going to be, I think we should march on Washington. We'll set up tents. We know how gay men love camping. Well, it got such a huge applause, I think we should march on Washington, that I said, well, I'm not going to do the rest of the joke. It's got this applause. So they formed the Minnesota Committee for the March on Washington, and then Harvey picked it up in San Francisco.
I called for that march on the Day of Freedom in Washington, D.C.
Today, the question of who first had the idea may be irrelevant. The important thing is that people, including both Harvey Milk and Robin Tyler, acted on the idea. But not all gays and lesbians thought it was wise at first. Around the country, groups met to discuss whether or not a march was a good idea. There was debate around the effectiveness of a march if the turnout was not enormous. The gay and lesbian community did not want to put together something of this scale and have a small turnout, which they argued would hurt their cause more than help. One of those who argued against it was Ray Hill. But Harvey Milk convinced him it was the only way to truly show the country that they were a minority population of the country that should be treated with the same rights as other minorities. But then, in the middle of this debate, tragedy struck.
At 11 a.m. this morning, San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and City Supervisor Harvey Milk were shot and killed in their City Hall offices. Board of Supervisors Dianne Feinstein, who now becomes acting mayor of San Francisco, made the announcement to a stunned group in City Hall.
As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed. The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
Thousands of quiet mourners have brought flowers for Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk to the steps of City Hall. For Pacifica in Berkeley, this is Lily Franklin.
In reports on that day, the emphasis was placed on Mayor Moscone's death. But it quickly became apparent that the death of Harvey Milk would be more significant historically. Milk was a hero in the gay and lesbian community because of his being elected to office, but also because he was so confident in coming out. And he encouraged all gays and lesbians to come out, saying their fight for civil rights would only be possible if their life was made public. And with his death, he instantly became a martyr. His death motivated people around the country to participate in the fight for gay rights, and undoubtedly helped inch many people closer to coming out. He famously said in one of his attempts to encourage people to come out, "Rights are not won on paper. They are won only by those who make their voices heard." The debate that had taken place about how effective a march would be if there was a small turnout had instigated gay rights groups across the country to organize train and bus trips to the Capitol. These trips were in some instances a multi-day traveling celebration.
The question of the day is, are you going to Washington, D.C.?
If I have to walk on my hands to Washington, I'm going to be there.
Holla, bro!
The mood was festive aboard the Amtrak Freedom Train as it left the
the Oakland, California terminal, carrying some 75 lesbians and gay men to Sunday's National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights.
The journey on the train has superseded my expectations many times over. I really am enjoying the sense of community, as short-lived a community as it will be, just, you know, less than a week.
I can't say the word. I don't know the word to say. It's been wonderful.
What's your name?
Dennis.
How long have you been working the railroad, Dennis?
Oh, about 30 years.
Is this going to be a trip you're going to remember?
Oh, I remember this trip for real. I never will forget this trip.
What is really exciting is that there are committees working in 49 of the 50 states.
Los Angeles March Committee organizer Susan McGreevy spent the last few weeks before the march working out of the Washington, D.C. office.
The only state that is not covered at this point is Nevada. The march has caught the imagination, I think, of a lot of people in the country.
I like the political interaction between the men and women. I'm real impressed with that. I'm seeing more and more of it, and I'm real involved in politics, and it's nice to be able to talk to men about politics.
The only thing I can say, I haven't slept much on this whole trip. I think we're probably all excited enough to where it is not bothering us that we haven't slept for 2 days now.
Dallas, Texas has 20 billboards going up there and in Austin, and they're taking some of those billboards away from fundamentalist religious groups, and they have even organized vigilante committees to make sure that they are not defaced in any way.
I appreciate the fact that we're not alone on this train, as we are not alone in the rest of the world. We have to talk to these people, and that's why we're going to Washington.
Jesse, is there anything you can compare this crowd to in your experience on the train?
Lovely, lovely crowd. I had some nice crowds, but this is the most loveliest crowd I've had.
How long have you been working on the railroad?
31 years. Still, people got nothing but compliments from all other people. Looks like you made that trip more happy. The eyes are open more now, I guess.
There's an old-line communist on the train, and there's a Bircher who thinks the metric system is a communist conspiracy. We've had a chance to talk to all of those people, and that's what it was all about.
Well, it's like one big family, and I didn't expect that. Because I'm not out that much, I didn't know what to expect, really. But it's like everybody knows each other, and it's a great feeling. I love it.
We are going, heaven knows where we are going. We'll know we're there. We will get there. Heaven knows how we will get there. We know we will.
This collage came from a documentary produced at Pacifica Radio immediately after the march. Remember, though, this is 1979, and not all of the country took the gay movement as welcome news. In Utah, some writers had the dubious honor of meeting Reverend Robert L. Harris, the first black elected official in that state.
The power of God is against you, Bill. We don't appreciate you being here.
October 11, early Thursday morning, Ogden, Utah.
This is the worst sin in the Bible.
What did you say?
God's going to have somebody that's going to tell you devil the truth.
What did you say?
Well, you read
the verse in Scripture.
You read the Bible.
I have read the Bible. I've read Romans 1:26 through 28, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:9 through 10. Listen, it was the story because God couldn't find 10 righteous people in it, period. That's what the Scriptures say. Nothing to do with homosexuality.
Homosexuality is the worst sin in the Bible. It's worse than the Bible. Like I say, I love you devils, but I'm going to tell you the truth, see. God is not pleased with you, see. And you know, most people don't have enough guts. Most preachers don't have enough guts. I surely admire Anita Bryant. Most people don't have enough guts. I really admire her. Most people don't have enough guts to tell you crooks the truth, see. But this is the only religious state that's headed by officials in the country. We definitely don't appreciate you coming here.
Well, we're on our way to Washington, D.C. to demand our rights, and we're going to Washington.
You have no rights.
Yes, we do.
You have no rights.
The time when you were told as a black you didn't have rights.
You have no rights. You have no rights. You're
a black George Washington.
You have no rights.
We do.
The only rights you have is a turn to the Lord. The power of God against you. My name. name is Reverend Robert L. Harris.
Harris, that's
mighty right. I go a little farther than that. I'm the first black elected official in Utah, the only one.
We heard you planned to throw yourself on the tracks. Is that something that you still plan to do, that they're going to allow you to do?
I've already done it. I laid on the tracks, yes.
Did they ask you to leave or anything?
No, they didn't know. This is a religious thing. They appreciate me doing something like this.
But you did it as a gesture. I mean, you're not going to threaten your life by the train,
are
you?
No, I'm not going to threaten my life. I just doing this to let them know that we don't appreciate them being here. God is against you. The power of God is against you.
It goes without saying, the party on the train did not end because of the men and women along the way who protested the train's passengers. More than likely, it fueled that energy on board. The party lasted for a couple days as the train meandered across the country. Then on Saturday, the train pulled into Washington, D.C.
The Freedom Train has just arrived this moment, and the passengers are about to disembark, and here they are!
We just finished coming across the country on what we called Amtrash.
Saturday night, October 13th, the Sylvan Theater, Washington, D.C.
At the Sylvan Theater in D.C., on the eve of the march organizers put together a show as part of the events going on that weekend.
People that are going to be on this show are going to be out of the closet, lesbian and gay entertainers only.
Come out of the closet and love me. Come out of the closet, be free. Come out of the closet. Come. I know it's the dark in there. So come out, and with a scream and shout and see everybody everywhere.
We can get our sisters and brothers on the streets of Washington saying that we are everywhere. We are together. We're gay. We're proud. We're strong, and this year is the year.
We cannot have people come to this country on visas. We are kicked by police. We have no employment rights. You can be put in jail for holding hands with your lovers in practically half the states of the United States.
It's time we recognize that this is a national issue. It has got national support.
We know politicians talk out of both sides of their mouths, and we want to know what they're going to do this year, not next year with promises.
We're going to ensure them of their civil rights and of their human rights, because we are going to save our children.
In 1969, outside the Stonewall Bar in New York City, for the first time in America, gay men and women demonstrated in the streets for their human rights. In the 10 years since the Stonewall riots, lesbians and gay men have fought to end the ignorance and discrimination surrounding homosexuality. But many Americans still oppose this effort, some with a Bible, others with violence. And this is what brings hundreds of thousands of gay men and women to the mall today in Washington, D.C. They've come from all across the nation, and many from abroad, to march from the Capitol building, march up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, and finally turning south to gather here by the Washington Monument. And many more gay men and women who cannot be with us in Washington today will be able to hear the voices of gay liberation in this national broadcast. And now, from the Washington Monument in our nation's capital, we bring you the rally at the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights.
And welcome to the rally. I'm Moira Rankin from the Sofa.
Wonderful time.
So nice to see a whole bunch of dykes.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. I feel so supported. So much a part of this.
You know, somebody said last night at the concert that there's like really two cultures here, gay men and gay women, and they're very, very different. There needs to be respect for the differences. Do you feel that way?
I feel that way, and I feel like there is respect here. There's been no antagonism that I can possibly see at all.
I think everybody's so happy that so many people turned out, that everybody thinks it's a miracle, and they're just celebrating together. Okay, Dale, do you want to add for the national audience? You want to say hi, Mom?
Hello, Mother. Hi, Mom.
Thank you very much. This is Amy Sands and David Winyard.
Bread and water, like some poor man's daughter, no, never for me. Wine and money, call me honey, and made me feel I was free. Like a glass raised too many times.
The march was peaceful and described by all participants as a tremendous success. There were some arrests, but not for violence. Reporter David Myers interviewed one man whose celebration ended abruptly.
We're talking here to Brett Booth, who participated in the March on Washington today, and he was in his uniform and was arrested. Can you tell us about that, Brett?
Yeah, I was marching down through the watch, through the march, and from behind, a military police patrol had grabbed a hold of me and pulled me out of the march and took me down to the station.
And you were in incarcerated at that point, I guess.
Exactly.
Did they actually put you in jail then?
Yes, they did. They slapped the handcuffs on when I got to the vehicle, and they kept the handcuffs on. I had to submit to a full search, and they put me behind a cage, not behind bars, but behind a cage, and I sat there by myself for about an hour while they were processing all the papers and legalities and whatnot.
David Myers then asked the sailor about life in the Navy, and it bore little similarity to the Village People song.
Do you find much hostility in the services towards gay people then?
Very much so. At my command, 2 months ago I was stationed on a ship, and because the ship found out that I was gay, I had 17 verbal threats and about 27 physical threats, attempts on my life to put me over the side while the ship was underway. And the ship had left for the Mediterranean, and so the captain realized what was going on, and so he stationed me on the base rather than staying on the ship because he knew that I was going to go over if I took the trip over there.
So your life was actually threatened then?
Definitely. Too many times. It's very scary. Very, very shaky. But I've coped with it for this long. And I feel now that I have even more things to fight for at a stronger point of view, and I've got people to back me up and people to help me. And like I said before, I'll fight to the top.
Reporter David Myers was able to briefly interview Kevin Muller, who is one of the event organizers and who had gone to the jail to look after the arrested sailor.
I was flabbergasted. I've been involved in this 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for at least 5 months. I always believed in it. And I'm the outpouring, the people, the emotions just overwhelmed me. At one point, I was introducing the various groups as they came down the street, and I had to stop because I just had tears in my eyes. It was just I couldn't even talk. I think it's important to bring out that this was not just a local endeavor. We had representatives from all of our states, from 21 countries. I met 4 women who came in from New Zealand just for the demonstration. I met some women from Adak, Alaska. Now, Adak, Alaska is in the Aleutian Islands, and it is 90 miles from Soviet Russia. So that's not exactly around the corner. The people were very well behaved. We had no problems. The only incident was the reason we're here, was Brett's arrest. But I'm just so thrilled, and from what I've heard, there are plans for another March on Washington. I'll be very happy one day when we don't have to have a march anywhere. But we are everywhere, and I think the most important thing about today's demonstration, and this must be brought out, is that we are everywhere. Traditionally in this country, when gay things happen, gay news happens, it's just in New York or California or the larger metropolis areas. But we had representatives from little towns we never knew existed. We are everywhere, and we're a politically active group.
The arrests were not the only controversy of the day. After the march, there was a contentious debate regarding the official count of the march. Estimates ranged from the ridiculous at 25,000 to the impressive at 250,000. Unfortunately, the 250,000 count was announced after someone overheard a police officer say, while pointing to the Washington Mall, "There must be 250,000 fags out there." In the end, the final number was estimated at 80,000. And finally, let's hear a cross-section of voices from that historic day, nearly 30 years ago.
In San Francisco, when they sentenced Dan White to 7 years, our brothers and our sisters got on the streets to expressed their grief and their outrage, and they burned a couple of police cars, and they dared to call us violent. Well, they don't have to tell us about violence, because they have violated us since the beginning of time.
I come from an organization where in the last 5 years, 12 of our churches have been arson and burned down to the ground. In one case, our minister and 10 of our church members were burned to death because of oppression, because of arson. When I hear people like Anita Bryant and Jerry Farwell from Lynchburg, Virginia, I think that town is aptly named, it really bothers me. People who claim the name of God, shame on you, you hypocrites. Let me tell you now, you don't know God. You couldn't possibly know God. I'm telling you today, as gay men and gay women, as we gather here on the Mall, we can have our victory. We can have our power. We have it already. We don't owe apologies to anyone in America. Not anymore. We're here to let Americans know we're your sons, your daughters. We're not going away. We're here, and we're going to have our civil rights no matter what. It's for us.
We really threaten uptight America, because one of the most effective ways to control people is through sex, through shame, through guilt. Remember it. We are the agents of one of the most important social transformations that has ever taken place since the beginning of patriarchy. But don't forget, we're outlaws. It's our great advantage. That's why I recommend it to you. We are the only minority group also that you can join overnight. In the twinkling of an eye, in fact. We dared to know pleasure. May I say pleasure again? I don't think it's been mentioned much today. Fellow criminals, never forget your nights in the days of your fighting for their freedom. Remember this experience. It is the tenderest, finest moment of our lives. So keep loving, keep making love, and soon there will be enough. Thank you.
The real irony of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights was that it both fulfilled and fell short of everyone's expectations. Those who warned that the age of apathy could not be overcome were surprised by the thousands of people who came from all over the country. Those who imagined that the march's success would advance the lesbian and gay liberation movement to a position of real power were surprised to discover that the impact of any event is determined by the significance granted it by the mass media. Thus is history reported and recorded. If a tree falls in the forest with no one to hear, does it make a sound?
You've been listening to From the Vault Remixed, a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that were used within this week's program, go online at fromthevaultradio.org. Or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's fromthevaultradio.org or 800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dulles. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel or other music used within this week's program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
like a picture of time. Well, he was the mother of America. He was my self-determined guru. Myself, well, I hold your big fat heart in my hand.
And this is Queer Voices.
I thought that segment was excellent. So glad we got that from the Pacifica Archives, and it reminded me, back in 1979, I was editor of a gay and lesbian newspaper in Norfolk, Virginia, during the march, so we covered the march. I took lots of photos of it. In fact, I have a whole section of those photos on my website, www.queermusicheritage.com, and lots of those voices and folks who gave speeches and so forth, I remember them well.
Oh, I remember those days, and I remember, unfortunately, I was still living in Beaumont, Texas, for God's sake, and I was only could only be there in spirit, but I knew that someday that it would make a great deal of difference in the way I live my life today.
Who we got on next week, do we know?
actually, we don't. At least I haven't seen anything.
Well, Deborah is our scheduler, and she's off tonight, and I'm sure she'll bring lots of info for us next week.
But one of the most important things next week is...
Queer Music Heritage.
That's
really
right.
Important to me. In the second hour, Queer Music Heritage. Again, that's my third of four-part series on transgender artists. I'm really getting into digging into the journeys of some of these artists. That'll be in the second hour next week.
Oh, well, just a quick little statement. Right now, the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is holding its screenings or interviews of candidates for the upcoming city election. Those of you who might be interested in such, you can go to our website at hglbtpc.org and contact us that way and see if you want to be a part and volunteer to go through some of the interviews with some of the candidates. Ask the questions you want to. And, of course, the endorsement meeting where the actual endorsements are voted on will be August 1st at Haven Center at 7 p.m. The reception starts at 6:30 and then the meeting starts at 7. All in our community are welcome, and for that matter, out of our community. All the friends and supporters are always welcome to the general meetings.
We want to thank our guests. Jennifer did a couple excellent interviews. I'll let you do that part.
Well, the first interview was with Mike Englehart. Mike is an attorney here in town and is intending to run for judgeship in the 08 election for the 151st District Court. And then, of course, the interview, which I was very interested in, was the with Brad Luna, and that was concerning the upcoming historic forum on gay issues with the leading presidential candidates. It's on Logo. It's on August 9th, and here in Houston, it'll be at 8 p.m., and if you don't have Logo, you can go to logoonline.com and see it.
During it or afterwards, because they're going to archive it.
That's right.
This is J.D. Doyle.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Glenn Holt.
Good night.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
discover what KPFT is like during its most energetic moments, now's your chance. Starting August 4th, KPFT kicks off its Summer Sizzle Pledge Drive, and we need your help to make it a success. You can put your spare time to use by volunteering to answer phones during the drive. Our phone volunteer trainings are Thursday, July 26th at 6 p.m. and Sunday, July 29th at 11 a.m. The sessions will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard. Your efforts make a difference and can make this a fun and successful drive. Evening and weekend shifts are available. Again, the phone volunteer training dates are Thursday, July 26th at 6 p.m. and Sunday, July 29th at 11 a.m. They will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard, near downtown Houston. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Let's face it, most of today's media caters to our love affair with celebrities and show business.
Or is it driven by a corporate conglomerate's bottom line?
A lot of the information you get is directed at a consumer-based culture.
That's why KPFT is an oasis you can turn to quench your intellectual thirst.
For independent, newsworthy journalism.
For diverse music and culture.
For radio with a purpose.
These days, you can't take this kind of radio for granted. Now more than ever, it's time to make a stand with your support of community radio.
365 days a year, we need you to keep this independent voice alive and well.
Simply visit www.kpft.org to become a member of not just a radio station, but an oasis of music, culture, news, and more.
That's kpft.org. Don't wait for...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.